The recordings have now started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the RPM sub-team for URS Documents Call, taking place on Wednesday, the 11th of April, 2018. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken via the WebEx room. If you're only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no one, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for a recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn the meeting back over to Barry Cobb. Please begin.
Thank you, Terry. Brian, were you actually going to say a few things to kick us off, or did you just want me to go and get started?
I was only going to say, why don't we let you set the scene, and then we can pick it up from there. So if you want to go ahead, that'd be awesome.
All right. Thank you. All right. Welcome, everybody. So for today's agenda, there's a very few of us. I don't think we need to worry about statements of interest or anything. For the time being, the agenda is going to be pretty simple and just review through one of the metric items that had been identified in our in the prior work of the document subteam, one of which is to analyze data around the appeals. You'll recall that of the cases, URS cases filed across the three providers up to 2017, there were fourteen cases where an appeal was also filed against the original case. And not really having much guidance or trying to at least try to do some of the heavy lifting for the group, staff went ahead and imported most of the information from each one of these 14 cases. As Mary mentioned before the call, this was sent to the list last Thursday, both in Excel and PDF format. Mary has also provided a link in the chat, which will point to a converted version of that in Google Docs. None of these are conveniently shareable within the WebEx Center, and not to diss WebEx, we've had the exact same problem with Adobe Connect as well. So it's all my fault because I live, breathe, and die in spreadsheets. At any rate, what I was hoping to do from the heavy lifting perspective is of these 14 cases, as I mentioned, I essentially tried to scrape the most important information from each one of the cases. All 14 of the appeals were, of course, by forum. And as it turns out, pretty much everything that was imported for each one of the cases in the appeals was pretty much just about every field within what is contained on the page of the forum site. And it was mostly with the intention of not trying to duplicate or recreate work, but in terms of trying to make it a little bit more convenient to compare a case and appeal side by side, especially across the sections where the findings and discussions are laid out in a pretty consistent template. So for today's call, what I was going to do is just quickly walk through the structure for each one of the tabs. And again, pick your poison for how you wish to follow along. What I'll be doing is I'll be referencing Excel on my own machine, but I'll try to also mention what page number I'm on the PDF. And if you happen to be in the Google Doc, then that will correspond to how I guide you through the Excel spreadsheet. At any rate, I'm just going to walk through the structure for one or two of these. I don't intend to go through all 14 of these in detail. Hopefully, everybody's done their homework and looked through them. And if you haven't, I do invite you to do so. I'm human and prone to error on occasion, so if I mess something up, please help correct me for the record. So Real quick, we're going to start on tab 3 of the Excel spreadsheet, which is the first case, case number 1550933, or that would also be page 3 on the PDF. And what you'll see before you are essentially three columns. The first column on the left-hand side are just all the different fields from the template structure of the URS form on forum site. And then the second column, or column C, is the original case that was filed. And then, of course, the third column is the appeal that was later filed beyond that. And moving from top to down, essentially the first, probably 10 or so rows are pretty much repetitive. Obviously, these are all forum as providers. The case numbers are the same. The links are slightly different, and per the URS procedures and rules, that if an appeal is filed, that when that is documented on the provider site, that it keeps the same case number, the difference being that an F is applied to the link of that of the case for the original case, whereas an A would replace the F in case there was an appeal. So each one of those links are different and will point to two different documents on the provider site. Obviously, the domains would be the same. The parties, for the most part, are the same. In some cases, they were cut and pasted a little bit different or something, but nothing substantial that parties didn't change or anything along those lines. One thing I will note, that in one or two of the cases, the examiner, when documenting the appeal, would also append that if the complainant was the appealee or the appellant. I think there were only two of those where those roles or terms were used in the appeal case. So for the purposes of this, I'm maintaining that the complainant is the same from the original case to the appeal, as well as the respondent. So, that's something that, that this group might want to consider as a slight possible adjustment, is that there is consistency in how the parties are documented across the two different case types. Registries, registrars, obviously remains the same. The examiner was different from the original case to the forum. And then the procedural history is kind of a mixed bag. In several of the appeals, the original procedural history, when the complaint was submitted, the commencement date, and the response date, in several cases was just cut and paste over. And if you see that there's a match from the original case to the appeal, I couldn't find documentation on the procedural history of the appeal. If there are differences, then the examiner at that point in time had documented that when the appeal was filed and when there was another response to that original appeal. Relief sought, in most cases, these were always the same, as well as the standard of review. I believe there are one or two small nuances, but it typically seemed to be kind of cut and paste information. And moving into the most important part of each of the cases is the findings and discussion across the three bands of, identical or confusingly similar, rights or legitimate interest, and bad faith registration and use. This is where the most variety in documentation occurred. In some cases, like what you'll see here on this first example, is that the way the examiner had documented that the complainant didn't satisfy the identical or confusingly similar, and therefore didn't bother, because they failed that particular band. They didn't bother to document whether the other two conditions were also the case. But if you were to look at the appeal, obviously the examiner there documented all three of those elements. And then, of course, then the most important part, moving down to row 26 on the spreadsheet version, is what was listed in the determination area and the determination date. Then moving down a little bit below that, then I documented if there was ever a dissenting view. And in a couple of the appeal cases, especially, well, obviously, where there were three examiners, in one or two of the cases, there was a dissenting view applied to the appeal. And then moving on from row 30 down below is kind of the analysis area of the form. And so the idea was to document, you know, who prevailed from the original case, how long did that process take in the original case, and then understand what happened to the disposition of the domain. Because only these 14 small sample, or not sample, but small universe of appeals existed, and the quick time frame by which the cases were executed, the disposition of the domain from the original case didn't change. That's not to say that it may have, but at least looking back through who is history, it wasn't prevalent as to whether the name got changed immediately to forum name servers or not, or you know, if any of those kinds of adjustments to the domain who is information had changed between the original case and the appeal. So most of the final disposition of the domain will occur under column 3, which I try to provide a kind of an end, beginning to end history, but trying to keep it small at the same time. Then there are the last two rows, which get into where the URS rules and procedures followed. What you'll know is that all of these are left blank. I didn't feel it was in staff's position to truly make a decision or a determination as to whether truly the rules and procedures were followed, because I'm not a lawyer and I'm not an expert in the rules and procedures. So for now, that can be left blank, and this group can decide, for the most part, whether all did appear to follow the rules and procedures, or if we need to go through and document where they might not have. And then, of course, other comments section. So that everything that I just mentioned for the last 8 or 9 minutes has been repeated as you move left to right across the spreadsheet or top down within the PDF across the two cases per tab or per page that occurred. I'm going to stop there for a second and see if there are any questions or comments before I'm going to run through just a couple of more of the cases on some of the unique things that that I found across these. And then I'll conclude with a summary of the findings, and then we can open it up to any comments or questions.
Hey, Barry?
Yes, please go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, and so just to supplement some of the things that you've said and then hand it back to you and have folks ask questions or put their comments. I see actually David's got his hand up, so I'll make this quick. As I noted in the chat and as you have it on the spreadsheet, before we get into the cases, there is a summary tab where, for what it's worth, the staff have tried to, you know, put in some numbers for you. Clearly, we're talking about 14 as the number of appeals versus almost 800 URS cases. So leaving aside questions of, you know, statistical validity, significance, and whether we can rely on them, I think it's worth noting for this group that a lot of these appeals essentially are against
one particular GTLD, that is the .email GTLD, and most of these were against yoyo.email. And I think folks who follow UDRP as well as URS jurisprudence will know that that particular respondent is has been involved in a lot of cases, let's put it that way. So, you know, we just wanted to highlight that we've tried to draw out some numbers for you, but that in terms of the number of 14 cases, half of them were related to the .email GTLD, and six of the 14, or six out of these seven, was against yoyo.email. Then in respect of Barry's comment about dissent, these were, I think there were two or three, and again, they were all in respect of yoyo.email cases, and I believe it was the same examiner in all three cases, and at least one of the, well, two of the dissents were based on a decision that he had made in a prior yoyo.email case. So this may be going into more detail than Barry had intended, but just to supplement some of the comments he had made as information for everyone as you go through the spreadsheet. Thanks, Barry, and back to you or David as you'd like to take the order of questions.
Thank you, Mary. David, please go ahead.
Barry, thanks. David McCauley here for the record. Thanks for this. This is interesting detail. And I guess my first question is sort of a procedural one. At the end, I thought you said two cases per tab in the spreadsheet. So I assume if that's what I heard, if what I heard is correct, that you're talking about the case below and then the case on appeal. Is that what you meant by two cases?
Yes, sir, exactly.
Okay, cool. The second thing is, and forgive my lack of knowledge of the rules, but when you talk about dissents, are all appeals before three examiners, or are some appeals just before one examiner? Is there an option that the parties can choose?
I'll ask Mary to correct me if I'm wrong. But in terms of the 14 cases where an appeal was considered or executed on, I believe there's just a handful. It was only two or three, maybe four at most, that had three examiners to review the appeal. And if I'm correct with the rules and procedures, then it's up to the respondent to choose whether he would like a larger examiner pool, one versus three, and I believe there might be a fee associated with that, but Mary maybe can correct me on that.
And okay, thanks. Excuse me. And just before Mary, just before you jump in, could I just ask one final thing? And it deals with on the spreadsheet, line 35, that question, were the URS rules and procedures followed? It strikes me that our interest, the working group's interest in this, will be with the original case and not with an appeal. In other words, if there's only been 14 appeals, it's my guess that we probably won't focus on the appeal side of this question, but rather on the case side. And so I guess the only thing we would look for in reviewing appeals is, was part of the appellant, well, I'm sorry to use that term, was part of the appeal claim that URS rules and procedures were not followed in the original proceeding. I don't know if you saw anything like that, but that would be my take on the rules and procedures matter. In other words, I think the working group's interest will probably be focused on the original examination. Thanks, Barry. Thanks a lot for all this work.
Thank you, David. That's, you know, in response, I think in general, that's another reason why I left those blank. I included it there just because it kind of came to my idea to my head, given that one of the other sub-teams is actually reviewing through the rules and the procedures. I didn't feel I was in a position to actually make that judgment call. That is part of the reason why the first tab, I did extract, those provisions of the rules and procedures where an appeal was at least mentioned. Obviously, that was just for mostly for quick reference sake. But ultimately, it'd be up to the working group to determine if we need to deeper dive in the original case to determine if the rules and procedures were followed. The last point I'll say is that in reviewing the actual appeals, nothing jumped out at me that any of the examiner documentation pointed to the fact that they weren't followed in the original case. It seemed mostly that it was all related to the original findings and discussion aspects that were brought into question in the appeal, but not the rules and the procedures.
Thank you.
And Mary, did you want to say anything in response to anything that was just said there, just for clarification or correction?
Thanks, David, and Barry. I'll note that Brian Beckham from WIPO and Renee from Forum have provided some information in the chat, and Brian confirms that the appeals panel can be one or three member, and I'll note that the appeals panel is appointed by the provider in question, and Renee has provided information that in terms of cost, a three-member panel with no new material is $950, and if there is new material, and I'll note here that under the URS, there is a limited ability and right to introduce new material, and if you do that, then the fee is not $950, but as Renee says, it's $1,300. Hopefully that's helpful, David. And there's also a comment from Griffin in the chat where he agrees generally with David, and he suggests that we can look at whether the issue of whether the examiner in the original case followed the rules and procedures was specifically raised in the appeal. He also notes that we should also probably independently review the underlying cases to make your own determination. So if I may, Barry and Brian, on Griffin's last point, that is something that the staff will leave for the sub-team. We've looked at the cases, and obviously, you know, it's not our role to draw legal analyses or conclusions, but the links have been provided in the spreadsheet. So that may be something that's helpful for specific members of the sub-team or the whole sub-team to just take a look at. And for what it's worth, having looked at these cases, not in as much detail as Barry, but just looking at, you know, who the examiners have been, what the grounds have been in terms of the decision in the underlying ruling as well as the appeals ruling, I tend to concur with Barry in terms of the conclusions that he has felt that as staff, it has been appropriate for us to draw. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Barry Cobb for the record. And I do recall within, I think it was just one case where the examiner did document that there was new information submitted and that fees were paid, but it didn't go into detail as to, you know, what the exact new information was. And that's not to say that new information wasn't submitted in other cases, but perhaps maybe the examiner just didn't document that aspect. And David, I see your hand is raised. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Barry. It's David McCauley again for the record. It's and while obviously those of us on the call now are part of the document subteam, I personally am not a member of the provider subteam, but it may make sense when we discuss that as a working group, the questions for the providers, to at least ask providers, has anyone ever made a claim to you, whether it was dropped or not, that that the rules were not properly followed? You know, in other words, we could go search the cases. I think that's right. But one other point of information might be simply to ask and say, have you ever received a claim that that's happened? So anyway, that's just just a statement. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, David. And I think Griffin put in the chat, footnoted as inquiry, and staff will take note of that. Okay. So, again, the intent of today's call isn't to go through these in detail unless anyone objects that we should. So, really, what I was just going to kind of quickly run through all of the tabs to the left, from the left to the right, and I'm only going to really be focusing at the very bottom of the form, rows 31 through 34. And that's just kind of quickly to just point out some subtle nuances that seemed worth documenting out of the standard information that was provided on the provider's site. And if for, you know, if you need to interject, please raise your hand and I can stop and we can talk about any one of them. So still continuing on page 3 of the PDF or tab 3 if you're following along on the spreadsheet versions, case 1550933. Again, this one is for the domain. It was for aeropostale.uno. This was the first appeal out of the entire data set that occurred. It did occur in April of 2014. The respondent ultimately prevailed, and the process was within 15 days of the original submission. I'd note that in terms of the response, that it looks like that was also within the 14-day window. The appeal was later filed, but unfortunately, the dates weren't documented on how quickly the appeal was filed and the subsequent response because of that. Ultimately, the examiner of the original case found that there was no evidence about the complainant holding a valid registration for the mark of the domain name. It was hard to understand exactly what had happened there. But after the appeal had occurred, the examiner did find ultimately for the complainant. The appeal was filed by the complainant, the complainant then prevailed, having satisfied all three prongs of under the findings and discussions. And this one was pretty much typical in that on around mid-May of 2014, the name server records were changed over to adrforum.com, which means that the domain would resolve to the suspension site. It did look like this name got renewed back in May of 2015. It wasn't clear whether this was as a result of the registry. It was impossible to tell who actually renewed the domain. And then again, it was also renewed the following year in 2016. But then eventually in the early stages of 2017, the domain went into the redemption period, and now it appears to be reserved by the registry and not available for registration. So any comments or questions about that one? Okay, I'll move on to tab 4 or page 4 of the PDF. This was, as Mary mentioned earlier, one of the Lutansa.email from the respondent, which was the yoyo.email group. The original case filed early April. The respondent did eventually respond. Looks like by the documentation that it occurred well into the third week of the month. So it did bypass, I think, the original 14-day window. The findings and facts were basically all documented, and the complainant prevailed in this particular case for a total of 24 days after submission. It looked like that the name had still continued to resolve up until the appeals outcome. So in terms of the appeal was filed about 10 or 11 days or so early May after the original case and commenced about 15 days later. There was an extension requested on this by the examiners, and I can't recall if this was for additional information or what the exact rationale was. Ultimately, the respondent, of course, was the one that filed the appeal, but the complainant prevailed within the appeal, and this took a total of 51 days from the original decision. And this is pretty consistent across all of the yo-yo email cases, with the exception of one, which we'll talk about here in just a minute. Essentially, you know, that the time of registration, it was to domaincontrol.com, which is GoDaddy. Around the end of May, the name servers were changed to Lufthansa email, and I believe that was to the ADR forum. Around mid-July, they were changed to ADR forum. Then the following year in March, the domain went into auto-renew period, and now the domain sits under DPML. Brian, I see your hand is up. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. Brian Beckham for the record. I just wondered, this may be a really silly question, but on this case, down at the bottom, there's a note that says that the name appears to have resolved up until the appeals outcome once the registry was notified. And this, the reason I'm asking is A, I don't know the exact process, what's supposed to happen when, in terms of the name resolving to the provider page that says the name's been suspended. But David asked a question earlier about broadly looking at whether the processes have been followed. So I thought this question for me fell in that category. I just wonder if you or anybody on the call happened to know what exactly was supposed to happen when with the name servers, with the name resolving, and maybe this falls into that category of just seeing that the processes are followed. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. And thank you for pointing that out, because this is one that, at least for this field, is kind of different than the others. And again, this was really the only second one that I had done, so I still was figuring out or feeling out exactly what all would be filled out in this form. So what I recall from the Whois history is that, and please, Renee, correct me if I'm wrong in any of these statements, but in general, the procedure is that once the registry is notified that a complaint has been filed, they have 48 hours or so to lock the domain name, and then just the registry lock is applied. There are no other changes to the domain name in terms of how it resolves or anything like that. It just prevents the registrant from transferring the domain name to another provider or to another registrar. Looking at the Whois history, and I guess this is probably easily to be embellished in terms of what I've actually listed here, because the name servers were still domaincontrol.com, I could kind of assume that the name would resolve at least to either a parked page of domaincontrol.com, which is controlled by GoDaddy, or perhaps maybe the registrant was using the domain name, but without going into like archive.org or, you know, really down deep into the history, all I can basically say is that, you know, the name was available to, or it was there for, you know, it could resolve. Now, once the original case has concluded, and if the complainant did prevail, and assuming that there's no appeal or anything like that, I believe that there is a time period by which the registry would then change the name servers of the domain, pointing to the in this case, udrforum.com. I don't remember what that time frame is, but in looking at the Whois history, it didn't look like the name servers were changed on this domain name until, what was the date here? Sorry. Until about a month, roughly after the determination date of the appeal. That's when at least the first who is or who was records showed that the name servers had been changed looks like around the 11th of July. Brian, please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think I forgot to take my hand down.
Okay. No worries. But anyway, I hope I answered your question there, and I don't see anything in the chat from Renee, so hopefully I didn't misstate anything that I had mentioned as it relates to the rules. Okay, so moving on to tab 5, or what would be a page 5 in the PDF. This was Wolfram CEO. As it relates to the procedural history, there was documentation between, or, you know, accurate documentation of the original case versus when the appeal was filed. In the original case, the complainant did prevail. That took a total of 15 days. I believe only a few days afterwards, two or three days afterwards, the respondent did file the appeal, but after the examiners reviewed the case, the complainant prevailed, and that took about 6 days time after the original decision. The final domain disposition on this one remained pretty much the same. You know, the name servers were changed to theforum.com. Looks to have been renewed at least 2 years. Then it eventually went into redemption grace period, expired. It does look like the name is available for registration again at the registrar. So this is a case where the brand of Wolfram didn't try to recover the name afterwards. Real quickly, I really want to, I hope you don't mind. I feel like I'm, this isn't a good use of time to go through these in detail. So I will bypass all of the yoyo.email ones with the exception where they did prevail. And I'm searching for that, so give me just a second, please.
And Barry, while you search for that, I just wanted to also come in here and for the record just note that particularly in that last row in the spreadsheet, the final disposition of domains, just so folks know, Barry did have to do extra work there to try and trace through who is history and records, for example, you know, what happened subsequent to the domain, because we felt that in that kind of situation, it would be helpful to see if, for example, the trademark owner ultimately opted for something like a DPML protection. So that information, that last row, is not necessarily information available from the face of the appeal, but is a result of additional research that Barry did. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you. All right, I just real quickly, there are two .email that I want to draw to your attention. This case number is 168-1062. This will be it'll be the next to the last tab from your right if you're looking at the spreadsheets, or the next to the last page of the PDF. And this particular case is somewhat interesting in that it does make reference back to some of the prior, or I think either the examiner was the same or that some of the documentation within the findings and discussion had made reference back to prior .email appeals that had occurred, but essentially the domain for this one is gray.email. which is a completely different party than the yoyo.email case. It was filed mid-June of 2016. Ultimately, the respondent prevailed in this one. And I should also point out that in the findings and discussions, like either like findings of fact or across the three prongs or elements of confusingly similar or legitimate interest and bad faith, if there was too much information, I didn't copy it from the provider site because then the cell really starts to get unmanageable, and that still even occurs now. So if they're blank or there will be a pointer, it'll be better to go to the actual case for this one. But again, ultimately on this gray.email case, the respondent prevailed. It took about 14 days, which was about the beginning of July, roughly. The complainant had filed the appeal 6 days later, and the respondent responded just about 2 weeks after that. This had a single examiner review the case, but again, it reaffirmed the original case, and thus the respondent prevailed on that one. It took about 33 days after the original decision, or probably, you know, I guess 47 total days from when the original complaint was filed. The interesting thing about this one is that the domain did enter an auto-renew period, but it looked like the registrant had renewed it. Then around it went into expiration again the following year in the 2016 and was newly registered by who is listed as the respondent here. So the name was owned by a completely different registrant in prior days. And then it was picked up a couple of years later after renewal. But then, of course, the respondent prevailed in this one, and there was no record of the domain ever changing name servers or anything as you would expect because the respondent prevailed in both cases. So out of the 7.email cases, this is the one that doesn't have to do with the yoyo.email incidents, and also interesting that it was just kind of the second newer registrant that had picked it up, which is likely what caught the attention of the complainant, but they didn't prevail in this one. Okay, now I'm searching for that other yoyo.email case where they did prevail. And I'm sorry, and I forgot what the number was. So I'm searching for that.
Barry, it's Mary. It's 1554808. That's Dewitt Weitzman, I think.
Oh, yes, thank you very much. So this is tab 6 in the spreadsheets, or what would be page 6 on the PDF. I believe that this was the second or maybe even the third yo-yo case. It's filed about mid-April. The complainant prevailed in the original case. It took about 22 days after the submission. I think that it did refer back to a prior case within the findings and discussion. Unfortunately, the procedural history wasn't documented in the case on this one, but there was a three-member examiner panel for the appeal. They did come in favor of the respondent for this one. Then there is ultimately, and what you'll see is that there are a couple of other comments listed on row 37 here. I won't bother with the domain disposition because ultimately, I will. So what was interesting about this case is that it made reference back to a prior case or the first.email case with yoyo.email, and it all circled around the rights and legitimate interest on this particular one. Even though the respondent prevailed, the final disposition of the domain shows that it is currently owned by the brand that originally filed the complaint. And I think everyone on the call is familiar that there was a court proceedings in UK or somewhere in the European Union regarding this particular case. I can only assume that the outcome of that particular case is the reason why Stuart Weitzman now has possession of this particular domain name. And perhaps this group would like, to draw in more details. I think there are other members of the working group that also have interest in what occurs beyond the RPMs that are within our scope. But this is one of those six that had prevailed, or where the respondent prevailed ultimately in the appeal, despite the other five not prevailing. So lastly, I'm just going to move to the second tab of the spreadsheet or page two, and I'll just read through these kind of just a short summary, and then we can open it up and determine next steps. So again, there were 14 cases that contained an appeal. 7 appeals were related to the .email GTLD, 6 of which were in regards to yoyo.email, and we saw that the respondent there did prevail in the appeal. The only other .email case was for gray.email, which we just talked about a little bit ago. So overall, there were 8 initial cases where the complainant first prevailed and then, of course, was later appealed by the respondent. And 7 out of those 8 appeals resulted in the complainant prevailing from the first original determination, whereas on the other side of it, there were 6 initial cases where the respondent prevailed, and that was later appealed by the complainant, and 5 out of 6 of those appeals resulted in the complainant prevailing. The one opposite of that is the gray.email case, which was mentioned. So in total, there were 12 appeals where the complainant ultimately prevailed and 2 where the respondent prevailed from the appeals perspective. And 2 of the 14 had more than one domain name. In both of those use cases, there were just 2 domains listed. And then in terms of the summary of the ultimate disposition of these domains, 1 is in control of the respondent, again, which is the gray.email case. 7 domains, and again, this is 16 domains out of 14 cases, so that the accounting matches up there. 7 are in control of the complainant, and either they're listed as the registrant or they're listed through their brand protection providers such as CSC or Mark Monitor. 3 domains ultimately wound up reserved by the registry or protected under the DPML. And there's a subtle nuance there. I believe one of the domains showed that the domain just wasn't available for registration via Whois, but it doesn't state why. Whereas some registries will state under, ICANN provision, or like Donuts will state under DPML. It just said it wasn't available for registration. Then, of course, 2 were available for or are available for registration today, and then 3 still resolved to the suspension page because they're some of the more recent cases to the right of the spreadsheet. So that's it, kind of the summary of where we land with this, so we're interested in feedback and have the group deliberate on what next steps or if anything else needs to occur from this analysis. So, Brian, why don't I, or Mary, let me turn it over to you to recap anything from a staff perspective, and then you can turn it over to Brian and we can go from there. Thank you.
Will do. Thanks, Barry. And I just wanted actually to follow up on the Stuart Weitzman case. First of all, for the, I think we've looked at the two appeals, gray.email and stuartweitzman.email, and as noted in the chat, for gray.email, it was found that there wasn't enough to satisfy the clear and convincing standard to show bad faith. For the Stuart Weitzman case, I believe, and I can double check on that, that actually after this URS proceeding was done, a UDRP proceeding was actually brought by Stuart Weitzman against yoyo.email, and that resulted in an order of transfer from the respondent to the complainant. So what that shows in terms of usage of these proceedings by at least one brand owner, I think, you know, we leave that up to this group and the working group, but I thought it was interesting to that there's certainly instances where a brand owner has used both for different reasons, perhaps. So I just wanted to put that on the record. In terms of next steps, and I'll hand it over here to you, Brian, you recall that this sub-team, in reporting back to the full working group at ICANN 61, that we had noted that in addition to this category of cases, which is the 14 appeals, there were two other types of cases that might be helpful to look at. One of these is the 58 cases where the respondent prevailed, and another, a broader subset, is something like 250 cases where responses were filed. So basically, the 58 cases where the respondent prevailed would have been a subset of that 250. Then one question there was, how much of this will already be covered by Rebecca Tushnet in her research? And from what her research assistant has informed staff, we think that they are currently going through it and we might get something from them in a couple of weeks. So one consideration for this team is what else you'd like to do, either about the 14 appeals cases. Is there anything further you would like staff to do with this spreadsheet or to look more deeply? We already have noted an action item that will check the provider questions to see if any questions about process were raised on appeal and so forth. Is there anything else? And then, of course, whether you want to proceed with the 58 respondent prevailed cases and if there's anything else to do, because one difference between this sub-team and the other two is that we are not going out with surveys of providers, practitioners, or other groups. So in terms of closure of our work, we don't have to wait for any kind of survey question review or responses from external parties. So just a reminder of where we are, and over to you, Brian.
Thanks, Mary. And anyone that has anything to add, please step in anytime. I think for me, the thing to do is, I think, first of all, Barry, and if anyone else worked on this with you, we owe you a huge thanks. Obviously, a lot of work went into this, and it was extremely useful to be able to jump straight into your document to read that for today's call. I thought what would probably make sense is, just building on what Mary said, to report back these findings to the working group. I noticed, and I think it's the second tab, I have actually a print-off in front of me, so I'm not sure if that's right. You provided a short summary. I had jotted down a few observations in the margins when I was reading through this. So what I would propose is that we build on the summary that Barry provided and put whatever observations we think are relevant to the working group, because, of course, the point of this effort was to see what policy observations we can make from the cases that we looked at and whether that drives us to the conclusion that some changes possibly need to be made to the RF. So I suspect that probably would make the most sense to do that offline, either one or two of us with Barry or the whole sub-team if people think that's better. If it were a smaller group, obviously it would need to be put up to the whole sub-team to see if people had observations or, as I'm saying this, maybe it makes sense for us to just go through those now, and if we run out of time, I don't think we will. I only have a few myself, would be to follow up within the sub-team over email to build out a more robust summary building on what Mary put together that we could report back to the working group. And then as Mary mentioned, I think before we would go any further, certainly I wouldn't feel terribly comfortable going forward with further reviews without circling back to the broader working group. I know there was a lot of discussion regarding whether and to what extent to review these decisions. So I think that we probably owe it to the working group to get guidance before any further reviews were undertaken. Does anyone have anything to add on top of that idea of a summary reported back to the working group, checking in whether they thought other reviews would be useful?
Brian, it's David McCauley. I have one suggestion, and that is, and I'd be happy to contact her, is to touch base with Rebecca and ask if her group is looking specifically at the 58 cases where the response, the lower court or whatever you want to call it, original URS cases where the respondent prevailed. To me, those would be the more interesting cases, I suspect. And so I just think it would be nice to know if they're going to do that because it seems like a natural area to focus on. Thanks.
Got it. Good suggestion, David. I think that makes sense. Obviously, if someone is doing this work, then it would be remiss not to have a look at that. And depending on what comes out of Rebecca's work, that can inform us. Mary, I think you've been in touch with her. Might it be possible to check in to see? For me, one of the broader observations from looking at this was that overall it seemed that things were working as intended. Of course, there were some cases where the case of first opinion was upheld on appeal. There were some cases where it was overturned. There were some cases within those two subsets where there were either one or three member panels. So, in other words, there was nothing that stuck out really radically when I was looking at these, and I think that's a useful observation. So maybe just to kind of give us a sense, if we want to, park our further review pending what Rebecca would look at, we might check in with her and just see in a very, very broad sense, was there anything that jumped out as being amiss, or did it seem that overall things were working as intended? And of course, within that, it's perfectly understood that with these cases, the facts and evidence before the different panelists are going to be different in each case. So you might have what on the surface appear to be different results, but there can be reasons that we as outside readers aren't privy to. And I know that was one of the questions that was discussed in some detail in the broader working group, which was, are there a certain set of half a dozen data elements that ought to be included in each determination so that people can look at these if they're interested to see that was something that was a reasonable determination. One of the things that I thought was useful and just kind of take advantage of having a microphone, I can add this over email to add to Barry's observations, were that it was encouraging to see in one case that the panelist positively recorded the fact that they were looking at the respondent defenses. I think we have to safely assume that they're doing that in all cases, but seeing it recorded gives us, I think, some assurance that they're actually doing that. And then I don't want to open up a can of worms with this, but one of the cases, they looked at the legislative history on this question of word marks versus marks with design elements. that may be something that we want to report back to the working group. I'm just reading Mary's comment in the chat that she was in touch with Rebecca and her RA, Alex, along the lines that I just mentioned. So, Mary, if you would be able to do that, that would be very helpful. And I believe she's actually on this sub-team, so we could even ask her collectively. I think for my part, those were the main observations. Barry actually covered most of them in his summary, or we covered them as we were talking through. I didn't have anything particular to add, and I think we in this sub-team have had the good fortune of probably having the lightest workload so far of all. So if that is amenable to everyone else, I'm certainly happy to take comments or suggestions for observations for the summary that we can report back to the working group. But I think, for my part, I think we've kind of covered off the task we were set out to do this evening.
Hey, Brian, this is Mary. So what we will do on the staff side is circulate the action items to the mailing list as quickly as possible. And obviously for the sub-team members, the immediate action item will be, as you suggested earlier, for members to provide input on the summary and the statistics, and you said you already had some. So we will compile those and we'll execute on the staff action items. Circle back with the sub-team once you've touched base with Rebecca and Alex, and then hopefully by Monday we will be in a position where the team has agreed on what you wish to report back to the full working group next Wednesday.
That sounds very good. I haven't seen any comments in the chat. I don't see any hands raised, although I don't think I can see those. So unless anybody has anything that they feel we haven't covered, I think we could probably conclude the call with this. I'm seeing an agreement from Renata in the chat, and I see previously from David that he agreed. So thanks, everyone. Thanks very much, Barry. This was very, very helpful. Obviously, a lot of work went into this. We owe you a huge amount of gratitude. And let's all put our thoughts in to build out the summary to report back to the working group over email. And have a good rest of the day, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian, everyone.
Once again, that does conclude today's meeting. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines. Lawrence, if you could please stop all recordings. Have a wonderful rest of your day.